Hello there, and welcome back to Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean, the podcast where we break down the movie American Splendor scene by scene. We talk about Harvey Pekar and discuss the joys and challenges of being professional cartoonists. I'm Josh Neufeld of joshneufeld.com.
And I'm Dean Haspiel of deanhaspiel.com.
And today we are discussing scene 16 of Scene by Scene.
No, this is 15.
This is 15, sorry. Well, now I'm confused because in the DVD chapters, it's chapter 9, but this is our 15th episode.
That's right.
Okay, so glad we got that figured out for you at home. This starts at minute 32, second 27, and ends at minute 37, second 11. And it starts with a shot of Cleveland, and it ends with cars at night on a highway overpass. And we call this episode Alice Quinn and Jenny Gerhart, because that's what they call it in the DVD.
Right. So the scene starts with another comic book caption. It's one of the transitional ways they move from scene to scene, is by honoring the comic book through comic book captions. And this one, it says, quote, "The short weekend begins with longing, dot, dot, dot." And I remember thinking, isn't every weekend 2 days? How was this a short
weekend?
Yeah,
I mean, weekends are at least 2 days right. All the time.
There's sometimes a long weekend.
Sometimes there are long weekends, yeah. But a regular weekend doesn't get called a short weekend.
So. Or has there ever been like a Saturday and then Sunday you went back to work with everybody?
Or maybe they just eliminated Sunday?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they were going for like a poetic thing with the longing.
Oh, like short, longing. Got it. Okay. Right.
So with that, we get a quick montage of Cleveland. We have industry, homes, churches.
A little note about that church. Mm. That church is the same church that was used in The Deer Hunter, the famous Michael Cimino Vietnam movie. Even though that movie was supposed to take place in Pittsburgh,
right?
It was filmed in Cleveland, and they used that same church exterior. So.
Oh, wow. I think we have a church like that here in Williamsburg, or a few churches in Brooklyn that look a lot
like
that.
Yeah, well, I think Brooklyn's called like the borough of churches.
Yeah,
so
especially Carroll Gardens, where I live. People are now living in churches. They're turning into condominiums and
that
stuff.
That seems blasphemous.
So anyway, we get this montage, and then from the church and homes, we get to see Paul Giamatti, who's portraying Harvey Pekar.
He's still playing him. He's the one who plays him the most in this movie.
Walks into a bakery called Elmwood Home Bakery. And then we cut to him picking out donuts, 2 crullers, a jelly donut. And he asks for day-old bread. And this is the first time I ever heard the term day-old bread.
Oh, really?
Have you?
That's like a thing.
That's a thing.
Like a lot of bakeries will sell their day-old bread for like next to nothing.
But what is it, like a crouton for your soup?
No, it'd still be good bread. I mean, it's not as fresh.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Okay.
If you make a pizza crust out of it or something, right? So
you're a bread purist.
That's right. I like when it's just freshly baked. Otherwise, why eat bread? Then go to Wonder. You might as well eat some Wonder.
Go all the way down to Wonder.
Go right to Wonder.
Wonder.
So a pretty woman recognizes Harvey and reminds him that they went to college together. She asks what happened to him, and he says that, you know, he got good grades, but the math requirement was hanging over his head, you know, so they're kind of catching up with each other. And then she reveals that she's been following his career as a comic book writer and a jazz critic. She's aware of it. She knows about that. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to me that she asks what's going on with him. Meanwhile, she has this in her back pocket.
Right.
She's aware of what's been going
on. Yeah, it is a little weird. It's like she talks about him as if he had disappeared, and yet she knows about this public persona of him. So.
Right. And I guess she's reconciling, like, between the person she knew in college and
right.
class.
Right, and it was 20 years ago.
20 years ago, and like, oh, this is what happened.
And he's only recently become known for his writing and stuff. So
that's
I guess
right.
It was that period of disappearance.
And meanwhile, he's so successful, he's asking for day-old bread.
Well, she might not have caught that little detail.
That's right. Anywho, so the mood immediately changes into a positive gain for Harvey, if you notice. But the tables turn when she reveals that she's a married housewife and mother. So it goes from like, oh, wait, there's this hot looking chick, you know, that I used to go to college with that, you know, I'm single now and she digs my wares. You know, maybe I'll go on a date or something like that. And then suddenly the next line is, yeah, no, I'm married and have a child and, you know, I'm domestic. And anyway, the wind is basically taken out of the room. And this is where Giamatti excels.
Or at least out of his sails.
Well, his face basically betrays a sourpuss. He's like clearly upset by the update. But then
and he doesn't even try to hide it in the slightest bit.
He literally, and that's part of the comedy, I guess, of the movie. Yes. You know, that's the romantic comedy part of the movie, right? And he's clearly upset, but then he turns his proposed fame and fortune into a man who has recently been divorced with a dead-end job, not doing as well as she thinks he is. And it's just a very funny scene where she has one idea about him, you know, based on, you know, lore and hearing, you know, word and following some of his career, to him, like, kind of like being smiley about it and totally, you know, going in for the possible date. That's what I read into the scene.
Mm-hmm.
To then flipping it and becoming worse than what she imagined, which again was, I guess, kind of like one of Harvey's little early tropes in his comics, you know, always the sourpuss, always like it could be better, you know, and
mm-hmm.
it's true. I get that too. You know, I understand that. Anyway, at one point they walk outside. They're talking about a book that he's reading, Jenny Gerhardt by Theodore Dreiser. It's a naturalist novel he hopes doesn't yield another depressing ending. And Alice Quinn says she thinks Harvey will be happily surprised. She gets into her car and offers Harvey a lift, but he gets sad and says he'll just walk back home. And she drives away. That's when the real Harvey Pekar's voiceover returns to the movie. So we start with the scene with a comic book trope of the caption.
Right.
And then, you know, Paul Giamatti performing as Pekar, and then we have real Harvey Pekar's voice come in.
Yeah.
And it's already been established that they've been doing this many times throughout, you know, the movie up to scene 15 here. So the voiceover returns, and then there's another montage. It starts with a montage and ends with a montage of a sad Harvey reading, sleeping, walking, as Pekar ponders loneliness.
As the real Pekar.
Yeah. And then this is all his voiceover, and he basically says he liked the Jenny Gerhardt book, even though the protagonist dies a dignified death.
Mm-hmm.
To him, that was what was the happy ending. He died a dignified death. Like,
yeah.
They knew it was going
to
be
the protagonist, who actually isn't the name of the book, though. That was interesting to me.
Well, it was. I think he said the main guy, Lester.
Yeah. So he's maybe more interested in the man in the story, even though
right.
the book is ostensibly about a woman. Which
right.
is,
and that's his takeaway.
Curious. Yeah.
Yeah. And as he's walking around being sad, looking all over like quiet, you know, Cleveland, he says, you know, life seems so sweet and so sad and so hard to let go of in the end.
Yeah.
But hey, man, every day is a brand new deal. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of turns a negative into a positive at the end, which he tended to do a lot in his stories as well. I remember, even with The Quitter.
There was a little sign of hope at the end.
There's always a little sign of hope, you know.
Or hopefulness, maybe.
Yeah. Well, and that's what happens. It's kind of like this scene kind of is prescient to what's going to happen to Harvey,
mm-hmm.
in a way. Not only is he going to meet someone, you know, that he falls in love with for the rest of his life, but it is going to turn around. And
wait, are you spoiling? Oh, man.
Damn it.
I only watched this movie scene by scene, so you've now told me stuff. Thanks.
Well, it's a romantic comedy. It has to have a happy
I guess you're
ending,
right? Yeah,
right?
I hope
didn't they
so.
Say that?
That's what they promised.
In the genre?
In the genre.
They promised in the genre. So the other thing that was interesting, I don't know if you wanted to add to this little recap. Was there anything more?
I love your recaps.
The other thing that the scene made me think about is, what would an American Splendor TV show look like? There's a quality to the scene that suggests kind of universal themes, woes, and desires for a broader audience. And I thought this was the one scene that just felt like, oh, everybody could, you know, understand and relate to this, you know, to this character,
right.
to the situation. And it made me think about, like, what if HBO would ever do, like, an American Splendor TV show, you know? And I feel like it would play like this in a lot of ways.
Huh. Like every episode would be him trying to get a date?
Yeah, it's like Seinfeld in a way, right?
Yeah, it's the ultimate TV show about nothing. Yeah, I guess.
And he keeps his wife in the basement,
whole...
you know, like in Seinfeld.
Oh, now it's getting dark.
Texas Chainsaw
Yeah, I mean,
Massacre.
I get another one of your favorites.
Leatherface.
You know,
just, Harvey Leatherface.
Is this like subliminal podcasting? Are you just throwing in?
Am I projecting again? I'm sorry.
Were you saying that out loud?
Wait, you said podcast. I thought this was therapy.
There doesn't seem much difference.
No. Or we can go get a haircut.
Yeah, I need one.
And that's also therapy,
but
by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, this comic book was like the first TV show about nothing, right? Like, that was kind of the whole premise.
Absolutely.
Was Harvey was doing a comic about things that nobody had ever thought worthy of putting in a comic before, and that was the joke with Seinfeld when it first started. Mm-hmm. It's hard to remember. We could go on a whole side conversation about Seinfeld.
I do wonder if who were the creators of Seinfeld? It was Jerry Seinfeld and the other guy who's really annoying that everyone loves. He has his own TV show now for years on HBO.
Right.
Larry David. David.
Yes.
I wonder if they must have been PCAR fans. They had to have been.
That's a great question.
You know?
Yeah.
Maybe we could look that up.
We'll look that up and we will probably forget to answer it next time. But we won't.
The scene made me think about suddenly we went outside of the realm of movie and into television. And as if you've been watching television in the last 5 to 10 years, television is almost better than most movies these days. Mm-hmm. You know, you can tell a longer story. You know, you don't just watch an episode anymore. You watch a part of like a 10 to 12 episode season, you know, a part of a bigger picture, you know?
There's always a story arc for the whole season.
Yeah.
And each episode is self-contained but plays into the larger arc.
And the thing that I found interesting about the scene, it relies heavily on the Alice Quinn story that Harvey wrote for American Splendor number 7 that came out in 1982.
Yes.
Drawn by Sue Cavey.
Who's appeared before.
That's right.
In this podcast. She illustrated at least one other story previously that was used in the film.
That's right. But in the comic, when Alice invites him into the car and take him for a lift, he accepts in the comic mm-hmm. and goes to, you know, continue their conversation. And she takes him to her home to meet her husband and her son.
Right.
And they have this longer conversation that expands, which I think it was smart to cut that because the scene did what it needed to do to get him to this place of loneliness,
mm-hmm.
you know, and yet optimism.
But it's sort of a sweet loneliness.
It's like an optimistic loneliness,
yeah.
right? Like, it's not so bad, you know? Like, he is doing semi-well, you know, in his own head.
Yeah, and he's reading
and people are interested in him, you know? And,
right.
And so, but I thought it was interesting how they cut it off there where it did continue. And did you have any more thoughts about the comic book, like, from what you read?
Yeah, so the original comic is quite different in a lot of ways, but I think essentially, as you were saying, the feeling of it is the same. Mm-hmm. So in the original comic, which is maybe 8 pages or so, it actually starts with Harvey at the bank and not at a bakery. And he spots the Alice Quinn character first mm-hmm. and kind of is thinking in his mind, do I know that woman? And then she does like a good deed and she helps this blind woman who had wandered into the bank, like get situated. And then she then notices Harvey and they strike up a conversation and a lot of it plays out very similarly at that point, but it was a bank, not a bakery.
Right.
And I'm wondering if there's some kind of, you know, symbolism.
Well, they don't have day old bread or day old money.
Day old money.
in the bank.
If they did, he would definitely want that.
They had to get that line in there, so they moved it to a bakery. But you said, you pointed out to me before, and when I was rereading the comic, there's a line that she specifically says, what was the average? The line about average?
Right. So, yes. And this actually relates to the movie, too. So, in the original script, Harvey declines her offer to go in the car with him at the end. But he says to her something along the lines of, instead of giving me a ride, you could give me the name of some of your single girlfriends. And maybe I could meet one of them. And that was basically taken from the original comic story where he did end up going back to her house and they had tea and talked some more. And then at the end, she said something like, come back over again sometime or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, you know, it would be better if you just gave me the number of some eligible ladies.
Mm.
So they cut that out in the screenplay. But the thing he says in the comic, well, she says to him, okay, but they have to be smarter than average or better than average,
mm-hmm.
Which is a callback, of course, to his line from American Splendor. Harvey's talking to his friend and asks him, so this girl of yours, is she smart? And the other guy says, well, she's about average. And he says, average is dumb.
Right.
So they're playing back to that line and they're actually showing in the comic that this Alice Quinn was a close reader
right.
of his work and, you know, was making a in-joke reference to him, mm-hmm, which was kind of a cool little moment in the comic itself.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty bold of him, too. It's like he spends the first half of the Alice Quinn comic story kind of digging her and pining for her in a way, because if someone he completely forgot about in his life suddenly shows up, appears, he's feeling lonely.
Yeah.
And it becomes like this, you know, one charged kind of incident to then the minute he finds out she's married with, you know, with a child, it's like, and then, and again, everyone can relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, you know, he goes to her home and is already like, could you hook me up with some of your pals?
I know. And he's like almost expressing his lack of interest in any further connection with her. Like it's inconceivable for him to have a, you know, a friendship or a connection with a woman who's not available.
And he even takes a shot at her husband, you know, by the way he describes him.
Mm-hmm.
And then says...
And says something about her kid, too. Like, the kid was okay. You know, he was polite and intelligent. Like, he was ready to jump down that kid's throat if he'd shown one little iota of not being, like, a good kid.
And because we currently live in 2019 during an era of outrage and permissions and apologies, it was also refreshing to, like, you know, go back to an old Harvey Pekar comic where he was being a little, you know, wrong, you know, in a way. Like, I wonder...
Well, like, I mean, he wasn't... You know, a jerk. He wasn't like, you know,
no, being honest. Yeah. Just being honest about what he felt. And I feel like that's being curbed these days a lot.
I don't know. I don't think that anybody could find anything objectionable in the Me Too era with him just having a, you know, a non whatever.
No, but they like, could criticize nothing him for not being interested in her as a friend or anything like that. No,
I don't know. I mean,
I'm not saying he was like a bad guy.
I think that's something you could criticize someone about in any era, no matter how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
But you also could just be like, okay, so he's looking for girlfriends. He's not looking for female friends. Like, that's just his choice. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily make him a sexist or whatever.
I agree. That's what I mean. It was like, I feel like today that would be someone would editorially say, maybe you shouldn't, you know, write that. That's my instinct, you know? But then again, he was self-publishing. He wasn't looking for any kind of guidance in that way.
Yeah.
So, and that makes me think about dating in comics. So I remember early on, I was very committed to comics since age 12. And then suddenly, you know, I'm very interested in girls. And I remember...
See, so now you are being, like, sexist to comics.
That's right. I was being sexist to comics.
You're no longer looking... to comics to fulfill your romantic needs.
That's right. And comics with an X.
Right.
That's right.
That's dirtier.
But so I remember one of the first things you talk about when you're revealing yourself to someone else is, well, what do you do? What do you like? And I always talked about comics, right?
Right.
And immediately you could see the eyes glaze. And like they were just not as interested, you know, and I always stuck to my guns with that. Like, I always felt like it was really important to me. You didn't need to love comics or even like them, but you had to respect that I like them. Just like I could respect what you like, you know?
But you also were not that cliched or that stereotype comic reader that
the nerd
lived entirely in the comic book store or in the world of Superman and the Fortress of Solitude.
That's
like
true.
You also had lots of other outside interests, including music and movies, just going to parties and
being
a social person.
But like, so did you have any interactions where early on, you know, when you're like in the dating scene and, you know, learning how to
I was
talk
not
to the opposite sex?
I don't think I ever learned that. Is there a handbook that I should have been reading?
Oh, there's plenty of handbooks.
Oh, really?
I think every week a new one comes out.
I just got lucky once and now I'm set.
Like you said.
I think I definitely learned early on not to bring up the comic stuff too much. I mean, I would be more likely to state proudly that I drew comics and that I was a cartoonist than I would to talk about like comics as a pastime. You know, so if I mentioned the drawing comics part and that really didn't get much of an interest or acknowledgement, then I would just move on and not bring it up again. So I wasn't adamant about it as you were, apparently.
But I was adamant because that's also how I made my friends. if you think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, you find like-minded people, right?
So, right.
And I'm not going to spend my life convincing someone, oh, I hope you like the things that I like so we can be friends.
Yeah.
You become friends because of the stuff you like.
It's often true, but even like back in our day, even in high school, even the high school that we went to, which was our high school, mm-hmm. there was only one girl that I can think of who ever read comics, which was Gina Cole.
Gina
if
Cole.
Remember her. Yeah.
She was a great
artist. She drew comics and was one of our better artists. But
I remember Jennifer
that...
Louie, I think. Remember Jennifer Louie?
Oh, yeah, I remember.
I think she was a great artist too, and I think she dug comics as well.
Okay.
So,
but we're talking about two girls out of 1,000 or whatever.
But then the same thing happened with our male friends. We mm-hmm. we gravitated towards each other in a way because of comics.
Yeah.
And there weren't a lot of male friends that were into comics.
No, but at least
like a handful, you know?
At least there was that handful.
Yeah.
And when I got to college, actually, one of the women that I started to become very close with was actually into comics. Well, she was into Will Eisner and The Spirit, and that was like a huge thing. Like, whoa, here's a female human being who can actually talk with some intelligence about comics.
And you immediately fell in love with her, right?
I did.
Like, you have to.
I did.
Because
it was very unfortunate
comics.
For a lot of people that that happened. But it's all better now.
Yeah. So, but that was in Oberlin, right?
Oberlin College.
And that was very
outside
open-minded.
Of Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to SUNY Purchase, which was another arts college. And then I transitioned from art, which I was having a tough time with. I just never really liked the fine arts, and I was always wanting to do comics, and I created a comic for the bi-monthly. Is bi-monthly every 2 weeks?
No,
that's every 2 months.
Bi-weekly.
So bi-weekly. This bi-weekly paper that I did this comic for, and again, trying to find my tribe there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just moved over to film because...
Yeah, what happened? You were at school for a couple semesters, and then you just disappeared. What have you been up to?
Oh, you're kidding. You're going back to the scene. I wasn't very good at math. I don't think any of us are good at math.
So actually that scene, I know you're about to tell another story, but sure. the math thing and college, that was a scene, that was some stuff that you covered in The Quitter, right? Like there was a big section of the book where about Harvey's college years and dropping out and stuff. So I feel like this is actually territory that you illustrated some.
I don't remember exactly all that stuff. I do remember that part of the conceit of The Quitter and why he called it The Quitter was because he felt that if he wasn't going to be excellent at something, he would quit it.
Right.
Which is weird.
He was so afraid of... It wasn't like he was even afraid of failure. He was afraid of just doing okay.
He didn't want to be okay. He didn't want to be average.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted to be the best at what he did.
Because average is dumb.
Average is dumb. See, it's a lifelong mantra he's had, you know, if you think about it. Yeah, that was to me the weirdest part of when he decided to call his origin graphic novel The Quitter, because for a long time it was called something else, at least for the pitch process.
Oh, is that right?
It was called Street Code.
And, what?
Yeah.
That was you did a comic.
All right,
Street
so
Code.
We didn't have a name for the graphic novel.
Huh.
And so I came up with Street Code because it was a lot of stories.
Wait, that's also, I'm sorry, isn't that also a Jack Kirby story?
Okay, so here we go.
Oh my gosh.
So I had posited that we call it Street Code because a lot of scenes happen in the street. He's out and about. Things happen. He learns stuff in the street. So he was cool with that. And so was Jonathan Banken, the acquisitions editor that also edited the book.
Sure.
And so was Vertigo. And part of the reason was, again, how I explained it, you know, where he was out and about. But also, I was paying homage a little bit to Jack Kirby, who's my favorite cartoonist, and his only autobio story he ever did was called Street Code, and that was basically about him and his real life Yancey Street Gang story. So one day Harvey calls up, and he actually sounded really angry when he told me that he wanted to call it The Quitter.
Oh.
And he explained it was because, you know, whenever he wasn't great at something, he'd quit it. Or you know, and that kind of stuff. And he just wanted to call it. And I thought, oh my God, that's like a terrible title.
Really?
Because who wants to read something called The Quitter? It's like saying The Loser, you know?
Yeah. Well, and there's a whole comic book series called The Losers.
That's true. But those guys kick ass, you know?
And so does Harvey.
So does Harvey, actually.
In literary
but
fashion.
He had to pick up the book. So I was...
I think it's a cool title.
Well, eventually I came around, you know? But then later on, I then did a autobio comic for DC Comics, webcomics initiative called Zuda.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I called my comic series Street Code, again, to honor Kirby. I love the title. And later on, I collected it as Beef with Tomato. But
good book.
Yeah, thank you.
Alternative Comics. Buy it on Amazon.com.
Thank you. So,
or sceneby-scenepodcast.com in the store section.
You can link to it.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I thought there might be a little bit to talk about dating in comics. Again, I think initially, you know, growing up, I felt like I was made fun of a little bit and, you know, obviously by everybody, not just girls, you know, like there's a lot of people who weren't into comics. Now suddenly, apparently the world is into comics, even though they don't read them.
They don't actually read them. They're just the basis for other properties.
Well, they're responding to cosplay and cinematic universes, yeah. You know, is what it is. So the takeaway for me for this episode was thinking about an American Splendor TV show, to be honest.
That's really interesting. I'd like to talk more about why you felt that this particular episode like made you think of
it's
TV.
Just the scene that locked it in for me. It just made me see the TV show somehow, you know, again having a more, you know, also because I have been pitching a TV show and a lot of the concerns
TV on your mind.
Yeah, the concerns that come up are like, well, how will other people be, you know, appeal to this, you know, how will other people like it? And that's like trying to create milk, you know, and you don't want to homogenize your stuff. And
you do homogenize milk, because if you don't, then you can get like all sorts of diseases.
So funny. You're the funniest man I've ever met. So I think that's a fear factor for a lot of creatives, is you don't want to homogenize your television show.
Oh, I see.
But you do want to do that for milk.
Right. Thank you.
All right. So was there anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to talk about the scene a little bit more, because this was always one of my favorite scenes in the movie. And it's obviously a pivotal scene because it sort of is like the transition from the single Harvey that we've sort of known all the way up until this point and the married Harvey that takes up the rest of the movie. But I just remember like back when I was in Chicago in the early 90s, in my mid-20s, and I read this story in American Splendor when I was starting to work with Harvey, and he had sent me like his entire oeuvre, and I was voraciously consuming like all these old American Splendors, that story really stood out for me, which is funny because it's, you know, done from a very different perspective. But I think there was something about the Midwestern sort of depressed, just general milieu of the story that's really captured by the art, by Sue Cavey's art, and that was, you know, very much part of Harvey's voice as a writer, that is a real connection between Cleveland of that time and Chicago, which was where I was living at that time. And I lived in a really like similar kind of post-industrial area that was sort of on the border of, you know, a lot of old factories that had closed down. And there's something about the way that they really capture that feeling in this scene, like when they introduce it, that sort of ties it in really well. And even though so much of it is different, you know, it takes place in a bakery instead of a bank, and it's not as long as in the original thing. The original story is so much about Harvey's like internal monologue. And here we just get that capper at the end where the real Harvey comes on. And his voice is so poignant. When you were quoting it before, when he talks about how he was thinking about all the people he's known and over the decades that have passed, and how life can seem so sad and so sweet at the same time. And a lot of that language is like verbatim from the comic, but there was something about this voice of Harvey Pekar, who at age, what, he was close to 70 when he recorded this, and he had already gone through two operations and having cancer, and his voice was kind of shot. It just really like sold that moment so well. And it's almost like he kind of was acting. Harvey Pekar was saying his own words, but he was really like giving them, I wonder how many takes it took, but he really, you know, he really served those words.
He gave it the gravitas that the scene, you know, was imparting, you know.
Exactly.
And you get to this, you know, different kind of a caption. It's a voiceover caption that sums up the scene in a really beautiful way. I agree. I know what you mean. You know?
I mean, I know that Harvey, as the real Harvey, has been the voice, you know, the voiceover previously in the movie, but I guess I never really noticed it in such an intense way as it was played in this film, in this scene. And also I have to say that Maggie Moore, the actress who plays Alice Quinn, is excellent in this role. Like, I think she was cast perfectly for how she looks. Like, she's attractive without seeming like a movie star. She looks like a regular person, but like flawed in the way that real people are. She looks like somebody who you could have imagined that Harvey could have had, you know, Paul Giamatti's Harvey could have had a thing with. And she just plays it so well. She's really down to earth. She's not trying to be cutesy. It feels like such a real encounter. And I guess when you see movies nowadays, it's such a rare thing to see two people having kind of an awkward conversation that just, you know, getting back to what you were talking about dating and comics and stuff, like those kind of awkward male-female or whatever iteration of could there potentially be something here? You know, those kind of conversations, it really brings back that that feeling to me from those days, and just felt very real for this movie.
And I think you're kind of spotting what I saw of how this could be a TV show from this scene, because a TV show could explore that more, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas in the movie, it's basically serving, you know, a moment to advance right. to the next moment.
Right, you get like one scene like this.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I just see the quality of how this could be the sizzle reel, as it were, to pitch the TV show
mm-hmm.
right here in this moment. You know, you get everything you need to know about Harvey, his, you know, budding legacy, you know, but what he wants is that connection with a woman,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right. And I remember that feeling well. It felt like there was nothing else could satisfy where I needed to go in life than having a romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. Like, you could have success and other things in all sorts of ways, but if you didn't have someone to share that experience with, then it just felt pointless.
Yeah.
So I thought he captured that really well. And the thing about this actress, too, is she's like kind of disappeared. Like, she's only had a few roles that might have been her biggest role in a movie. She was also in Dark Man. You remember Dark Man?
Yep.
Sam Raimi film.
Liam Neeson.
And I think she had a really small role in that. She was also in Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Mm.
But again, like, I think a pretty, you know, almost like a cameo type of role. And then this, where she has this solid scene. Other than that, I think she's done some TV work, but maybe she doesn't pursue acting that seriously. Or I just wonder why, you know, I've never seen her again, because I thought she was really excellent in this.
She definitely stands out in the movie for the one scene she's in.
Yeah. And I just also have to call back to that scene when that moment when she says, you know, I'm just a plain wife and mother. And we have this shot of her, of Paul Giamatti's face going through every iteration of from hopefulness to utter, you know, hopelessness and also kind of angry. Like, now he's like pissed. Like, why did I even bother? You know,
and maybe even jealousy. Maybe it's like,
yeah,
I want that with you.
Exactly.
Or I want that in my life.
Mm hmm. And it's funny because then retroactively you're like, wow, so that was actually Harvey being charming. Like the moments before,
yeah,
when he was like reluctantly talking to her,
yeah,
and complaining, that was his attempt at being suave and, right. and charismatic.
Romantic comedy.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's this cut. Did you notice the cut? Like when they finish talking in the bakery and they're sort of, I think both talking about Jenny Gerhardt. And there's just this moment. Oh, no, she says, that's my favorite book. And they just stare at each other and they hold it. They hold the shot for like a beat too long.
Mm-hmm.
And then it cuts to them going outside and continuing the conversation. I just love that mm-hmm. awkward cut. Like,
well, it's a connection. It's a human connection
yeah.
as well. You know,
it's awkward and it's like truthful and connecting at the same time.
But think about it, too. Like what you just said, like that's how he connected with. You know, he connected with people through comics. He connected with people through jazz. And now
right.
he's connecting with her over this one book.
Mm-hmm. And this book, that's the other thing I wanted to say. And this came from the original story as well. This does not seem to me to be a random thing that they actually have Harvey saying, I hope this isn't like, you know, Theodore Dreiser's other work about a protagonist who's crushed to earth by forces he can't control, which, of course, is his great fear. Like that's what he's been fighting against mm-hmm. this whole movie, and that's why American Splendor the comic came to be. And then she says, well, it's not your typical Hollywood happy ending, but it's truthful, which is, you know, very rare nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that is this movie. The two of them together just sort of summed up what this movie is
right.
and what the audience should expect from it. So it's really meta. So one last thing, and this is actually really important. So Harvey, they made a specific choice to go from the bank to a donut shop. My theory on that is because Harvey famously loves donuts, and there was no other time where they were going to bring the donuts in.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you is, what are your thoughts on donuts?
So I really like donuts. My favorite donut is a glazed donut. I don't like when donuts get too fancy. I feel like there was a donut craze recently.
Yes.
Where they were a little more expensive and maybe...
$4 donuts.
And I think that's disgusting. I think... listen, I think the best cake is an Entenmann's cake.
Okay, I can't go with you there, but I've seen you bring those out. So
my grandmother worked at a donut shop for years was a kid. So I would go and greet her and get a donut.
Nice.
I love Dunkin' Donuts. I like their coffee.
Do you like their donuts, though? Their donuts are bad.
Their glazed donuts are great. I mean, again, I don't go too fancy.
You're not into, like, the pumpkin donuts or the ones with, like, little people drawn on them?
I'll tell you partially why is because I'm not a connoisseur. Like, when I go eat certain kinds of ethnic foods, you discover... Ethnic.
Like ethical food, like veganism?
Yeah, ethical food. Okay. That's me. You find the three or four things you like to eat. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
And then you specialize in those.
And then you return to those. And then you try to find, you know, do they make it as good at the other place? The new place, the old place, whatever.
No, I'm similar.
But with that in mind, I don't eat a lot of donuts because I'd weigh a ton. So if I'm going to
Are you saying donuts aren't healthy?
Well, mentally they might be.
Okay.
But, yeah.
I thought with the little hole missing, like, that was
that helps.
Good. Yeah, that helps.
That's right. But they sell those too, Josh.
The donut holes. I've heard of this. Yeah, that's a Dunkin' Donuts thing.
So for me, if I'm going to occasion rarely a donut,
you got to portion it out.
And then I've discovered the donut flavor I like. And the other one would be the jelly donut.
Hmm, that's a classic.
I'm not a big fan of the powdered jelly donut, like the one that he orders.
They're messy.
It's a little too messy.
Yeah. He was very serious about his donut order. Like, mm-hmm. he really was thinking like two crullers and a powdered, and it was serious planning and strategy for him.
Well, you know, when you're lonely, you eat sugar. that's what you do. And I remember eating lots of pints of raspberry sherbet or mint chocolate chip ice cream, you know.
Haagen-Dazs?
Yes, Haagen-Dazs. Yeah. That's what I like. And so, that's what you do. And so what's your favorite donut? What are you trying to get to here?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. Like, I would not pay $4 for a donut, but I have been known to go down the path of the artisanal donuts.
Like Krispy Kreme? I can't stand Krispy Kreme.
I was into them for a while. Then I realized they were too sweet. It was just too much. But there's, like, a donut place in Greenpoint called Moe's Doughs.
Yes, and Chris Miscavige, every time he goes to my studio, brings a box of that.
Yeah.
And I get angry every single time.
Because you eat them?
Because not only do I eat them, and I say, don't bring this here because you're going to make me eat them. And then he just snickers and laughs because he's an actor who's in shape.
Evil.
You know? He's just trying to get me to be more fat than I am.
Yes.
That's mission.
That's always people's mission.
But yeah, Moe's Doughs. It's called donuts. I get it, Moe's Doughs. And actually, I don't really like them. He always brings these chocolate ones.
Yeah, they've got a whole variety of...
And it's not like a chocolate, like with a chocolate glaze or a frosting.
No,
it's just like
the
plain
whole thing
chocolate.
Is chocolate.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not a fan.
Oh, interesting.
And then I eat about three of them.
Because they're there.
Yeah, they're there. Yeah. He doesn't eat them. He has half of a donut where he just looks at me
eating. Which he holds with, like, one finger raised.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. With a monocle and an ascot.
What an ascot. I like those. And mostly because they're not $4. They're like $1 each.
Which ones?
The Moe's Doughs.
Oh, they're cheaper.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought they were like artisanal or something.
No, it's just like a regular place that makes interesting...
So it's classic.
Unusual donuts.
Like a classic donut shop.
Yeah.
Okay. I forgive them.
Yeah. They seem like good people.
But were those the donuts that Harvey ate? Those particular ones he orders
Moe's
in the
Doughs?
Movie? No.
Oh.
The crullers and the powdered jelly donut.
I don't know. I wonder how much, research went into that in the movie.
Well, they had the man on set. So
I know, so...
It's possible.
Yeah. But I think by the time the movie had come out, he had, like, gone to a very healthy diet, right? He wasn't really eating that sort of stuff anymore.
You know, I think he'd become a vegan, but he also was a fan of craft services, from what I'm told.
So it was like he was a vegan when Joyce was around and not when she wasn't around. But, you know, this brings me to one last thing that we really do need to cover, and that I felt like we really dropped the ball from last episode, which was... There were jelly beans, and we didn't talk about jelly beans.
Our favorite jelly beans?
Well, I just can't believe we never talked about it. I mean, they were there scene. They were talking about them. They're there. So we didn't discuss jelly beans. And, you know, I...
Well, there's only one answer in one word.
Ronald Reagan?
That's two words. And that's no answer. No, licorice.
You like licorice.
That's the best.
They're good. I like licorice.
You can't beat a licorice jelly bean.
Are there licorice jelly beans?
The black jelly bean, isn't that licorice?
Okay, but what about the fancy jelly beans that Toby was handing out, the ones with pina colada flavor and all that stuff?
Too fancy. It's like the donut. You can't get
so
too...
You're in the same. See, I like, again, this is where we differ. Mm-hmm. You know, this is how people can tell us apart, is that I like those fancy jelly beans, but they're very frustrating because they're so small that you eat one and then you're like, okay, I got a little flavor of popcorn or whatever, but... It's not enough. Like, I want 10 of those. And then there's never enough, and they're very expensive, and you just go down.
That's how they get you.
Dark, yeah.
That's how they get you.
All right, now I see why we don't talk about jelly beans. So, I think that covers it. Anything more that you wanted to touch on in this episode?
No, I think we covered it. I think we realized that American Splendor could easily be a TV show.
Right, a homogenized...
No.
Milk show.
No.
No. Sorry, not homogenized. Right, that's right. That's, sorry.
I have to take a knife to this episode. Jesus.
So that about wraps it up. Remember, you out there, you can visit us at scenebyscenepodcast.com. That's our official website. And also, we are Scene by Scene on Facebook. At our website, you can subscribe, you can download past episodes, you can read up on the show, you can check out our work, including all things Harvey Pekar, and join the discussion. So until next time, when we will be discussing episode number 16, this is Josh Neufeld.
And this is Dean Haspiel.
With Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean.
No, wait.
What? You scared me.